Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 175, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Jeremy Wolf of Associated Retinal Consultants in Royal Oak, Michigan. We discuss trocar-assisted intrascleral fixation of three-piece intraocular lenses, among other topics. A list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. Also, you can now claim CME credits via the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply click on the link in the episode description to claim CME for select episodes. If you are surprised that we, and particularly I, have been quiet on the NBA front, don't worry. We're saving it for a mega podcast coming out July 1st. We will mostly discuss retina in that podcast, but we do have some juicy thoughts to share. I know that 95% of you do not care, but for the 5% who do, look out for that. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Jeremy Wolf. Dr. Wolf is a partner at Associated Retinal Consultants in Royal Oak, Michigan, where he also serves as Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at Beaumont Health. This is Dr. Wolf, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jay. Glad to be here.
So you're a new guest. All new guests get the same question before we dive into the good stuff, which is, how did you first encounter ophthalmology, and then why did you decide to become a retinal specialist?
So, my actual first encounter with ophthalmology, of course, is like many of us was as a patient, but I'm emmetropic. I'm one of the few ophthalmologists to be emmetropic. I enjoy great vision, and I had some type of ocular migraine as a child, best I can remember. So that was my first interaction. Didn't really mean that much to me. And we got to medical school, and I went to the Medical College of Ohio, which didn't really have an ophthalmology department. But a vision was just a fascinating thing to me. So I took a year off and studied as a Hughes Fellow at the NEI, and got more interested in ophthalmology there, and then it was just a really fascinating field, and the combined, surgery and medicine, and I felt like I was going to be able to be a patient's doctor, kind of, no matter what they needed as far as their eye went, I was going to be able to take care of it, and I found that very appealing.
So let me ask you, your time at NEI, who was your mentor, and what sort of research did you do?
So I worked with Carl Chalky, who is now in Texas. At that time, Carl was a full-time NEI physician, physicians and scientists. So he had a clinic, and he had a basic science lab. So I spent a year there, and we worked on rodent models of CNV. And at that time, feeder vessel treatment was kind of a new, interesting thing. So I spent a lot of time in the lab creating CNV and then seeing if I could make it go away with feeder vessel treatment.
Well, and then, you did your residency at Emory and then went on to your fellowship at Wills. And again, kind of going back to you, it sounds like you had a background when you were doing your research in medical school that it was in the retina. Was this something that you were thinking retina when you went to Emory, or did you decide along the way?
Yeah, so I think you're right. So my interest in ophthalmology was also, started with the retina. And so I think I had some predisposition in that way, although I tried to keep an open mind, but nothing really convinced me or made me want to change from retina after that.
After your time at Wills, you then went to ARC, and we'll talk a little bit about the group and what it kind of means and what it represents. One of the things you and the rest of the members in your group have talked about and really kind of made popular was the scleral fixation technique using trocars. It's almost what they call the modified Yamane technique. Obviously, videos are much more useful, and listeners who are listening can find any of your videos online that you or one of your great fellows, former fellows such as Aristanos, Yoshi Onokawa, have put online. But just briefly kind of describe how that technique came to begin, or how did you guys invent the technique, and then what it involves when you do it in your hands, when you do one of these techniques?
Yeah, so we have spent a lot of time on it, and I tell you, it never ceases to amaze me how many of these come around, and it has definitely evolved over time. So one of the ARC former fellows is Jonathan Prenner in New Jersey, and John does a lot of these, and so a lot of this is kind of a back and forth. So Yamani has his technique, and even before that was popularized, John was doing this scleral fixation where he was embedding it in the sclera but making tunnels, still using trocars but making flats. We kind of started there, and then pretty quickly evolved to trying to do this as a sutureless type procedure, because a lot of the kind of mucking around and difficulty came from trying to deal with getting into these tunnels and burying the flap in the tunnel, and you're taking down the conge. And so George Williams and myself and Lisa Faya and Tara Kassan are kind of the people that tend to do more of these. And so over time, we've just kind of evolved to where we are now. And we all do things a little differently. But we are all doing it now, transconjunctival sutureless procedure, as opposed to taking down conge and cutting scleral flaps and burying it. And, you know, that's been an evolution over, you know, probably now, I'd say 5 or 6 years that it's really taken off.
You know, we're going to talk a little bit about nuances of the technique, and that some questions that will come up when we talk about it. I mean, first of all, when you do the technique, I mean, when there is a lens already in the eye, and again, it would ideally be a three-piece lens with proline haptics, how do you make the decision of whether it's a lens that the haptics are in good enough shape to do this? Because I think one of the concerns people have is, for example, when you're pulling the haptics out, there may be breakage, or the haptics are kinked or bent. It may not be as smooth. The lens may have been tilted. So do you always do a kind of a plan that you may have to swap this lens out? And what do you kind of look for to be like, well, you know, maybe this probably isn't the best lens to fixate?
Yeah, so I think the most attractive form of this is as a rescue, as you say, so a three-piece in the eye that's dislocated. But I have to tell you, if I have aphakic patients, I do the same thing. I just put a lens in. But it's hard to tell preoperatively what's going to end up being doable and what's not. So I approach each surgery. So if there's a dislocated eye, a dislocated three-piece in the eye, I approach the surgery as though I'm going to rescue it. But I have ordered backup lenses so that if I can't rescue it, then I will explant it and then, you know, typically scleral fixate the new lens.
And let's talk about the de novo. So when you're not rescuing, when you're putting in a new lens, do you like to keep it in the front part of the eye? Do you like to work most more in the posterior segment?
So doing the same technique, whereas I'm doing this sutureless scleral fixation, but what I typically do, actually, I like to have it in the vitreous. And so what I do is I insert it with the leading haptic into the mid-vitreous, and the trailing haptic I leave in the wound, the corneal wound. And then I go under biome visualization, and using a max grip, I just grab the end of the haptic, which really is pointing straight up at you. You know, it's hanging in the vitreous, just pointing right at you. So it's pretty nice. I only need to use one forceps then. I don't do the hand over hand, which I find personally cumbersome. So I prefer putting it in the vitreous and working with one instrument.
Now, I spoke to some of your former fellows the first time I did this, and they told me a couple of nuances, which I think are really important to avoid problems. One of the first things they told me was when delivering it with the forceps, it's pretty important to grab at the end of the haptic. And the second thing they told me was when delivering the forceps out of the eye, to make sure that the trocar isn't still there. So do you routinely have your assistant do that, or do you routinely just slide the trocar up the forceps as you remove that haptic?
Yeah, so that's exactly what I do. So, and I agree, it turns out that the fellows are paying attention. I agree completely with those points. So, you know, grabbing the tip of the haptic is vital to kind of, number one, making it get out of the eye without, you know, a lot of resistance or, frankly, damaging the haptic, because if you haven't grabbed it at the end, it's going to fold over itself to come out. And it, basically, as soon as I have grasped the end of the haptic, I flip out the biome and grab a Nugent and slide the cannula up the shaft of the forcep before I externalize the haptic.
Now, I think one of the again, tough things is once you've externalized the haptics, do you routinely flange or do you not? I know the flanging was something that came out of Beaumont. And if you do flange, why do you do it? And I think you guys published a little bit why flanging might be helpful.
Yeah, and so I do. I flange every one of mine at this point. And the study you're referring to is a study we did where we took cadaver eyes and we did this this technique. And with flanging and not flanging, we used 27 gauge instrumentation for this, and then used a measured the force it required was required to disinsert the lens, and we found a statistically significant difference. So it was much harder to dislocate these lenses after flanging when using a 27 gauge setup. As opposed to leaving them, you know, kind of naive or untouched. And so after that, I've just flanged everything.
Now, you flanged that one. Now you go to get the second one. Sometimes I feel like getting the second one is almost harder in a lot of ways than getting the first one. Though I'm sure as you do it more, it gets easier. And the flange, for example, you said helps prevent it from long-term their stability, but maybe helps, especially if you're doing 27 gauge from it, sliding back into the eye. Once you get that second haptic out, one of the things I struggle with, again, is looking at it and kind of getting a sense of how much the haptic should be exposed on either end. How much of the haptic should be coming out of your tunnel at the end? How much visible blue should you see? And then what do you do relative to the conge at that point? How do you kind of minimize the risk of erosion in the early postoperative period?
Yeah, so initially, when I wasn't flanging, you know, I'd like to see a millimeter or so, and we have some other data that suggests that's a pretty good amount to have exposed and not be putting a lot of stress on the optic-haptic junction. But with flanging, I reposit the haptic into the sclerotomy so that just that blue bulb that I flanged is visible, but I've pushed it back into the sclerotomy, and so I like that because I know that I have a pretty symmetric amount of the haptic out on each side, and I feel my chance of erosion, which really has not been a big problem for us, but I still feel like my chance for erosion is lower because I'm basically putting it, you know, into the sclerotomy, so it kind of, you know, wedges in a little bit. So for that's what I do. Not what everybody does it at Beaumont, but that is what I do.
Now, let's talk about the kind of the things that have come in the post-operative period and maybe kind of the other adjacent issues. The first thing is anterior segment surgeons will do the Imani. Some anterior segment surgeons have started doing this in non-vitrectomized eyes. What are your thoughts on that? And then if you are a retinal surgeon and you're doing this, how thorough an anterior vitrectomy do you like when you're fixating using this technique?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm going to answer that backwards or the opposite of way you asked it. So I believe in a very thorough anterior vitrectomy when I'm doing this technique, and that's just born through experience. Because if it gets caught in the vitreous, and I've had that, it's really painful. Because as you can imagine, you frequently have one of the, you've already fixated one of them, one of the haptics, and then the other one is stuck in the vitreous and the lens is stuck over there and it's plastered into the vitreous base and you're trying to dissect it out and you've got a terrible view and you're worried about damaging the haptic that you've already fixated. So I spend an extra, 2 to 5 minutes, shaving the vitreous base in these cases, which I don't do in all my cases, all my other vitrectomies necessarily, but in these cases I do. I think that anterior segment surgeons who leave the lens in the anterior segment and don't disturb the vitreous very much may do just fine. But I worry a lot about how much traction is put on the vitreous just based on my own experience of having these lenses interact with the vitreous.
Now, one of the things you presented at the Vail meeting we were both at was discussing doing UBMs in these eyes afterward and getting a sense of where the lens sits relative to the iris. What did you guys find? And then talk a bit about doing a peripheral iridectomy, either at the time of surgery or postoperatively. Is this something, do you do PIs now routinely in these cases?
Yeah, so, I had several patients who presented after surgery with this very atypical anterior chamber presentation where the iris was basically adherent to the lens, and it looks like a reverse pupillary block almost, which is really bizarre when you think about it, because the lens capsule is gone, and these lenses sit pretty posterior. They don't sit where a normal in-the-bag PCIOL sits. It's a little bit more posterior than that. And so we started looking with UBMs at our patients after surgery. And what we found was that the iris is way floppier after the surgery. Well, and I think that is largely the same thing you see in aphakic patients, where the iris is much more mobile. And so as a consequence of both kind of the clinical experience of seeing some patients come in pupillary block and then seeing how mobile the iris is. And when I say it's mobile, I mean, when we were doing these UBMs, there were a certain number of these patients that the iris, like in a normal blink, the iris would come back and contact the lens implant. And normally it's a nice normal distance away. So there's a lot of movement there, and that prompted me to want to start doing the PIs. Also because the way we fixed these patients we saw after surgery that had this kind of unusual iris configuration was with a PI, and it resolved. And so now instead of waiting to see if somebody's going to have this problem, I do routinely do a PI at the time of surgery.
You do, and is there an important place to place this? Is it really, do you like to just nasally or temporally as you would normally, or do you think it matters?
Yeah, I don't think there's an important place, Jay. I think it's a whatever you can access. I would say that it is easier to do before you fixated the lens, just because you got to come right up around it, and it's a little bit nerve-wracking sometimes to watch that, but no, I'd say, typically, I guess I probably end up more often than not being a kind of like inferior nasal, just because, it's easier to get anterior with the cutter if you're approaching temporal, from the temporal side. So I wherever it's easy, I just like to have it.
And then, so let's talk about criticisms of this technique. So I think, and you probably have heard all of them presenting this at conferences and very, both in civil and uncivil terms, that people have very strong opinions about, anterior chamber lenses versus suture lenses versus fixated lenses, and suture can be iris or scleral suture lenses. And I'm sure it's all different depending on what you're most comfortable with is probably the best technique for a given patient. But I think that the two criticisms that come up for this technique, the first is the long-term risk of erosion has been brought up. And you guys have shown in your series really good safety in terms of really not much erosion happening. And then, you know, people go out and adapt these techniques, and maybe it's not optimal patient selection, and they end up with erosion and endophthalmitis and other issues. And the second is tilt. And people have said, well, there's tilt and there's astigmatism and patients are unhappy. So like any technique, there's again, nuances to avoid this. You mentioned a little bit about what you do for the conjunctiva. In terms of patient selection, what sort of things do you do to avoid erosion? And then what are kind of the most important things to avoid tilt? Again, you mentioned a little bit of how you start the procedure, but why do people get tilt in these cases?
Yeah, you know, so I think your points are all well taken. And I think, you know, tilt is definitely a legitimate concern. And to me, I think one of the biggest things or biggest issues with this is I typically do my fixation superiorly and inferiorly. There's nothing saying that you have to. You could do it horizontally if you wanted to. But I typically do it inferiorly and superiorly, and identifying the limbus, well, we think that that's a you know, pretty easy thing to do. It actually turns out to be tricky, especially in the operating room under that under the operating room light. In the office with the slip beam, it's way easier, and I have been caught surprised on my post-op day one when I look at them and I realize that what I was measuring as the limbus really was a patient who had a lot of panis, and I wasn't nearly where I thought I was. And so I think the easiest way to end up with tilt is because you're not really measuring equally on both sides of the eye. And then the other ways, and then there's other ways you can end up with tilt. You know, if you make a much different tunnel on one side or the other, or you're at a much different angle, you know, going into the eye as far as kind of whether you're parallel to the cornea or whether you go off of that. So any of those things could potentially affect tilt on the lens. And so I think that's why it is a concern. And for some people has been an issue because there are many different ways you can get there. So I'm pretty careful to try, you know, I use a toric marker to measure 180 degrees apart. I go 2 millimeters back from the limbus, and I identify kind of the blue line best that I can to make sure that I'm measuring kind of from the same point, both superior and inferior. And then I try to be very, very intentional about making my tunnels at really the same angle of attack into the eye so that the tunnel length is about the same. And then also, in regards to how I am to the cornea, I try to mirror that so that everything kind of lines up.
You know, last thing before we go, you know, you've been involved in teaching fellows. You were at the inaugural Alcon Fellows course where you were teaching this technique. Before you go, and I think, again, the lifeblood of people who listen to this program are the fellows and the trainees who are always looking to pick up extra tips and learn from different attendings. What's kind of this is a very open-ended question, so you can take it any way you'd like, and you can even use IOL techniques or other things. What are kind of the biggest things you'd say to, you know, a graduating fellow, or a couple months from graduation now, that you've learned when you went out into practice that maybe you didn't expect, that it could be surgically is what I was referencing, but it could even be in the office, that you're like, wow, you know, I have good mentors and I learned a lot of things, but this was really a different thing or an adjustment once you become an attending?
So that's a great question. And I think I could talk on this question itself for a long, long time, but I'll be more directed. I think that, so speaking surgically, you know, you and I went to a fellowship where we spent a lot of time doing surgery and we learned a lot. And I felt really like I was a great surgeon. And when I finished and started in practice myself, I have learned an immense amount in the time that I've finished fellowship. And that's not to say that I didn't have a great surgical training. I did. But there is so much that you just can't learn, and not because there's a problem or not because you haven't done enough cases or anything else. There's just situations are new. And so the idea that you're kind of at your peak when you finish fellowship and you've done more cases in a year than you're going to do in the next 4 years, maybe, it's not true. And you got to keep an open mind and keep on learning and figuring things out, because you're going to keep getting better.
That's great. That's super optimistic way to finish. And I agree completely, having done three PVR detachments this morning, each one different than the next. So, Jeremy, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. Our listeners will too, and I hope to see you soon.
Hey, thanks, Jay. Great show. Really appreciate everything you do.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 175 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. In addition, you will find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. You can now claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. Simply log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. On our website, you can sign up for our mailing list. That's the best way to get updates on the most recent episodes as they release. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcast Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback from things we can do better and things we're already doing well. We also appreciate any who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Wolf for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venicasa for preparing this episode. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.